ain't misbehaving. They're just behaving.
Ain't misbehaving, saving my love for you.
Welcome to this episode of Ain't Misbehaving.
I'm Dr. Louisa, and I'm here to talk about your pets, some problems you may have,
and this episode's bonus question. Have you ever wanted to go back in time? In certain circumstances, it is really possible. More about this after we talk about last episode's bonus question. What can you never eat for breakfast? Yes, we are often on very restricted diets, but all too often we break those restrictions. But this is one restriction you can't break. You can never eat lunch or dinner for breakfast. So, back in time, I hear you ask. I thought you called yourself a scientist. Well, yes, I do. I studied science in college, but this concept comes from a real scientist, a woman who has a PhD with a strong background in ethology. That's the study of behavior for the rest of us. Her name is Carolina Westland. She is an associate professor of ethology at the University of Stockholm. She has a passion for teaching how behavior management can be used to improve animal welfare. To this end, she has online courses and free webinars, as well as the occasional blog post. Her website is ILLIS.SE/EN/. I have not met her, but I always learn something from her blogs and webinars. And one thing I learned is how we can go back in time. She has a lot to say about animal emotions, not just dogs or cats, but her experience includes birds, horses, goats, and many other species I am probably not aware of. She has a wonderful course on animal emotions. Here is a snippet of what she talks about. Emotions are not neutral, and they impact an animal's learning. Emotions can be pleasant or unpleasant. And here is the jaw dropper. Emotions spread backwards in time. Yes. Here's what happens. There is a pleasurable event. That pleasurable event is preceded by other things happening. And the emotions associated with that pleasurable experience will rub off on those events and stimuli. Those events that happened at a previous time. The animal learns predictors of that pleasurable event and comes to feel the same about the predictors as he does about the event. Events become predictors of the emotion that follows. Here's an example. A walk is a pleasurable event for your dog. If you walk him on a leash or harness, and there are amazing sights and glorious smells, this elicits great pleasure. Then the pleasure of the walk spreads backwards in time to the presence of the leash or harness. Eventually, when you get out the leash, the dog expresses joy. You can use that to spread the emotions back even further. Get out the crate, get the leash, then go for a walk. The crate then becomes the predictor that the leash will come out and then a walk will happen. Now, this can also happen with unpleasant events. If a dog dislikes having his nails trimmed, you may bring out great treats to tempt him to hold still. But beware, what can happen is that the great treats become a predictor of a nail trim. The dog can learn something like, here is chicken, there must be something bad about to happen. They stop liking chicken. This happened with my husband. He likes vegetables, and not just the good stuff like corn and carrots, but he also likes broccoli, chard, cabbage, cauliflower, and squash. But he doesn't like Brussels sprouts. You would think that Brussels sprouts would be just like little cabbages, but no. There was one time when he got sick after dinner and associates that with the Brussels sprouts. One experience, and now he won't eat them. Another example happened to a friend of mine. While taking a shower, there was an earthquake. No damage, just a lot of shaking. Now, her dog is afraid of showers. In my episode on using the clicker, I talked about classical conditioning where the click precedes food and how the sound itself can bring on a pleasant experience. But there is a phenomenon called poisoning the click. For example, take the nail trim again. We want the nail trim to predict the click that predicts the food. But this needs to be done very slowly so that the dog never has an unpleasurable experience. We need to allow the dog the choice of giving us his paw. If we go too fast and grab the paw as we are clicking, then the click will predict the unpleasant thing. The emotion spreads back in time, so now the click itself becomes an unpleasant thing. We have poisoned the click. Whenever we are training, we need to pay attention to our pet's emotions, and not only the emotion of fear and anxiety. High arousal of any emotion can interfere with learning. Even a dog that is overjoyed to greet you or is excited about seeing another dog will not be able to pay attention to anything else. So emotions, good and bad, relate directly to training. And training is not just obedience training. It is not just teaching cues for sit, down, stay, and such. Training is happening all the time. Every time we interact with our dog, they are learning something. We just need to be sure that they are learning things we like. Fear has its uses, and fear has kept many beings alive and able to live on and reproduce. Those who showed no fear often ended up getting eaten. Fear has a survival purpose. Those that have the genetic makeup for experiencing fear go on to live and pass that trait on to their offspring. So there are many things that are innate triggers of fear. Things like loud noises, quick movement, some smells, any novel item, pain, and lack of control can all elicit fear in a young animal. We need to deliberately expose the animals to these things with a pleasant outcome so that the pleasure spreads back in time and helps change the fear to enjoyment. I want to talk about something I'm very familiar with, a visit to the vet. I have been on both sides of that encounter. I learned early on in practice that dogs and cats often saw me as the needle lady, not a fun thing. Many dogs and cats that had a previous scary experience extended that fear to me. They wouldn't even take a treat while in the clinic. And we know that eating and anxiety are incompatible. That is an extremely important concept that I will revisit from time to time. A visit to the vet is not a neutral experience. That is for the owner as well as the pet. The goal of both the vet and the owner should be to make it a happy experience and not a fearful one. People assume that a vet visit is a scary thing, maybe because they have some of their own trepidation about going to the doctor. I know of one person in particular. After I graduated from vet school, a former classmate died from a rare bacterial disease. Like many awful diseases, it began with flu-like symptoms. The course of his illness was rapid, and he died in a matter of days. We were all stunned by this, and it brought home the fact that none of us are immortal and that something like this could happen to any of us. At that point, my husband and I made an agreement that if one of us thought the other might not be well, then we would have them make an appointment to get the matter checked out. Well, one day, my stoic husband had a fever that worried me, so I asked him to go get an exam. He balked at that and said, "I hate doctors." "Oh, well, thanks," I replied. He came back with, "Oh, no, I mean real doctors." "Well, thanks a lot." Veterinarians have taken a proactive approach to helping their patients overcome anxiety. There is a program called Fear-Free Pets that has courses for veterinarians and their staff on how to make vet visits more comfortable. They call it Taking the Pet Out of Petrified. Fear-Free provides online education to veterinary professionals, pet professionals, animal welfare communities, and pet owners. They also have an exam available for the veterinary professionals to become a certified fear-free practitioner. I took the exam and it is fairly rigorous. Not only does it cover the basics of recognizing fear, but how to approach each pet at their level of comfort and how to maintain a fear-free environment while the pet is staying in the hospital. One of the hardest parts of being a fear-free practice is to convince the owner that it is the best way to go. Not that any owner wants their pet to be afraid, but the best fear-free routine is to have the pet take a treat as the procedure progresses. If at any point the animal stops eating or shows signs of being upset, then the procedure stops and the question becomes, is this procedure necessary or can we wait and work up to it another time? If the problem is something like an ear infection that can't be put off, then the pet is sedated before continuing. But if it is something like a nail trim that doesn't need to be done immediately, then the pet is sent home and a plan for desensitization is put in place. But some owners just don't want to wait. They might say that the pet just needs to be restrained and just get it done. Then it is a needed conversation to let the owner know why it is in the best interest of all to choose a different way. Each time a pet is frightened in a situation, then the next time their fear will increase. And as we found out earlier, that fear will spread backward in time to things that come before the visit. Things like riding in a car, getting into a crate, putting on a leash can all predict a vet visit and become problems in themselves. It is well worth the time to help our pets become fear-free. You can find a certified fear-free vet at the website fearfreepets.com. How can we apply this knowledge of emotions to pet behavior and formal training? First, let's consider the difference between training and behavior modification. With training, we are wanting to have the dog do a desired behavior. We ask the dog to do something, and the dog does that. With behavior modification, we are working with changing the animal's emotional state. With training, we often think of the basics like sit, stay, down, come. But training is more than that. It is teaching the dog how to act with you and with others in the house. It is letting the dog know what you want and how they can be well rewarded for that. It is learning each other's ways of communicating. Not only does the dog learn the cues you are teaching, but that you are learning what the dog is feeling about it. Remember, emotions impact learning. Both fear and excitement will interfere with learning. We want our students to be happy and alert. In another episode, I will talk about the laws of learning and operant conditioning. What I won't talk about is calm, assertive energy. I'm not even sure what that means. There are no scientific studies that define any of those terms. Science dictates that dogs learn through operant conditioning and classical conditioning. Training methods that claim that the dog learns by your energy or by you feeling the dog's energy are simply not based on science. Similarly, training that suggests that you take on the role of a leader harkens back to dominance-based theories that have been disproven by research. The whole idea that we need to be alpha over our dog comes from some observations about wolves and their pack behavior. The problem with drawing conclusions from those observations is twofold. Dogs are not wolves. They are a different species separated by thousands of years of evolution. And much of the observations about pack behavior was done on wolves in captivity. This may not reflect their behavior in the wild. The American Veterinary Society of Animal Behavior has written a number of position statements about behavior and training. You can read the whole position statement on dominance theory, as well as several others, by going online to avsab.org and look under resources. That's avsab.org. AVSAB is a group of veterinary and research professionals with a special interest in animal behavior. I can say we since I am a member of AVSAB, support the use of scientifically based methods of training and behavior modification, and we promote interactions with animals based on compassion, respect, and scientific evidence. EVSAB is concerned with the recent reemergence of dominance theory and forcing dogs and other animals into submission as a mean of preventing and correcting behavior problems. Dominance is defined as a relationship between individual animals that is established by force, aggression, and submission to determine who has priority access to multiple resources, such as food and preferred resting spots. When I first began studying behavior, dominance theory was still a part of recommended dog training. We were told that we had to eat first, since we had control of the food resource. We were told that we had to go through the door first, since that reinforced our dominant position. Suzanne Clothier, in her book, Bones Would Rain from the Sky, talks about how silly this is. If we have to go through doors first, then if we get into a car first, then how do we get our dog in? We were also told that we needed to show dominance over our dogs by doing what was called an alpha roll. This is where you roll the dog on his back and hold him down. I bought into this early on, and when I got a new dog, I thought I should do this to him. When he was staring at me, which a submissive dog is not supposed to do, I lifted his legs out from under him, laid him on his back, held him down, and stared at him. I immediately regretted it. He turned his head, flattened his ears, tucked his tail as much as he could, and started shivering. I was appalled at what I had done. I had just made my new dog afraid of me. I had to work very hard from then on to repair our relationship. In our relationship with our pets, priority access to resources is not the major concern. The majority of behaviors owners want to modify, such as excessive vocalization, unruly greetings, failure to come when called, are not related to valued resources and may not even involve aggression. Rather, these behaviors occur because they have been inadvertently rewarded and because alternate appropriate behaviors have not been trained. Consequently, what owners really want is not to gain dominance, but to obtain the ability to influence their pets to perform behaviors willingly, which is the accepted definition of leadership. It is important to understand body language when we interact with our dogs. Eyes, ears, lips, tail, and the position of the dog's body all tell us what emotional state our dog is in, and some of these can be quite subtle and easy to miss. A quick lick of the lips can indicate nervousness. Have you ever experienced anxiety? Did your mouth go dry? Did you wet your lips with your tongue? Another physiological event that goes with anxiety is that the pupils will dilate. Easy to miss if you're not looking for it. There are several good resources for learning canine body language. Turd Rugas has a wonderful video called On Talking Terms with Dogs. It shows many of the signals that dogs use to communicate with other dogs. We can learn those signals too. It is hard to talk about body language without using pictures, and that's kind of hard to do on the radio. But there are some good visuals on the website drsophiayin.com. I will put the body language poster on our website, radiotacoma.org. Dr. Yin contributed a wealth of information on helping dogs out of their fear and anxiety. She is deeply missed. Understanding canine body language is critical when training a dog. We need to know the emotional state our dog is in. If they are too anxious or too excited, that will interfere with learning. About 30 years ago, there were some evaluations done about behavioral traits of certain breeds of dogs. They listed traits for 56 breeds, as well as the predictive value for each trait. Among these traits were excitability, general activity, excessive barking, and playfulness. One trait they listed puzzled me. They listed which breeds were more easily trained in obedience. High on the list were breeds like German Shepherd, Doberman Pinscher, Sheltie, and Poodle. Low on the list were breeds like Basset Hound, Bulldog, Beagle, and Fox Terrier. Remember, this book was published in 1988, when the Keeler method of dog training was the norm. I call this traditional dog training. I wouldn't recommend the Kaler method for a soft-tempered dog because it will probably do more bad than good and might leave your pet traumatized. If I have to compare the Kaler method to something, I would say that it's similar to the old teaching methods when teachers severely punish students for the smallest transgression. If you choose the Kaler method, don't attempt it by yourself. Get professional help because many things can go wrong in the hands of an inexperienced person. Here are some excerpts from the website on the Kaler method. Quote, "This method doesn't rely on treats to encourage your dog to obey, but rather on correction." Well, what this tells me is that they don't understand the concept of operant conditioning. They imply that using food is bribing the dog, whereas in operant conditioning, the food is out of sight until the click. It is not a bribe. It is a reinforcement. The website goes on to talk about some techniques used by Kaler: throw chains, electric shocks, slingshots, suspending the dog off the ground, and more. Kaler didn't believe in gentle corrections, saying that they are cruel and disturb the dog emotionally. Today, certain passages in Kaler's book can make for difficult reading. Here's one. "Hold the dog suspended until he has neither the strength nor the inclination to renew the fight. Once lowered, he will probably stagger, loop-legged for a few steps, vomit once or twice, and roll over on his side, but do not let it alarm you." Really? Just reading it alarms me. If you search for the Kaler method and look at images, you will most likely to find German Shepherds, Doberman Pinschers, and Golden Retrievers there. It is my belief that these dogs are considered more trainable, not because of their breed, but that they are more forgiving of abuse. It might be likened to Stockholm Syndrome, where emotional bonds may be formed between captives and captors. But there are many dogs that might not be so forgiving. Can you imagine giving electric shocks to a French bulldog? Or suspending a dachshund from a leash? Can you imagine a basset hound or a chihuahua forgiving you for hitting him with a slingshot? Well, corrections and any type of punishment can backfire and create more problems than they solve. Marie Sidman wrote a book called Coercion and Its Fallout, and Carolina Westland has a blog post titled 20 Problems with Punishment in Animal Training. That topic will take an episode all by itself. And as I said before, the emotions elicited by punishment spread backward in time and can result in fear of many things you might not have even thought of, like you and your treats. No pet owner that I know wants to have their little loved one back away from them. These emotions, both fear and excitement, can interfere with learning. It's like being in class and having the teacher smack your desk with a ruler. Then you are asked to learn fractions. The adrenaline running through your system competes with the cognitive portion of your brain. Hard to concentrate when that ruler is still in sight. Alternately, high arousal from positive emotions can also interfere with learning. Imagine that classroom again. It's snowing outside and you just got a new sled and there's only 5 minutes until the bell. The teacher says, "Okay, now we're going to learn fractions." Hard to concentrate when there's such a fun activity in store. And it's the same with your dog. When there are doggy friends nearby to play with, it is not the best time to train. Even having super high-value treats can be so exciting that it is hard for the dog to concentrate on anything except the amazing food. They are not listening. So now, let's differentiate training from behavior modification. Training is teaching communication so that the cues we use mean something. The animal, whether a dog, cat, bird, fish, or anything that eats and has a nervous system, needs to be in an emotional state where it can remain attentive to what we are doing. Fear or excitement will interfere with this. Now, behavior modification is working with animals that are in a highly charged emotional state. Destructive behavior from separation anxiety or noise phobia, aggression to children or strangers, and even some unwanted peeing or pooping can be based in fear. Remember, They ain't misbehaving, they're just behaving. Teaching them to sit and stay when they are in a panic because you are leaving simply won't help. I have two dogs that illustrate these principles. My older dog is a long-haired German Shepherd called Scarlett. Her full name is Scarlett O'Hare. I got her as an adult from the Humane Society. They found her in the zip code of JBLM and estimated her age to be about 5 years old. My younger dog is a Belgian Tervuren called Flicka. Her full name is Flickerickadicka. She was born October 5th, 2019, and I was there at the time, so I know precisely how old she is. Flicka had a lot of early puppy stimulation and exposure to novel sights, sounds, and people. From 8 weeks to 14 weeks of age, she had numerous puppy playdates, outings to parks, and Home Depot. This is the age of socialization, where things that they are exposed to in a happy way become part of their world. With Flicka, I do training. Some of the behaviors that she has on cue are touch, where she will target my hand, flip to heel position, bow to me, come to front, and weave through my legs as we walk. My goal is to get her an American Kennel Club title of trick dog. Scarlett, on the other hand, came to me understanding the cues for sit, stay, come, and down. She had been trained. All was well until I took her for a walk and she lunged and barked at one of my friends. This could be quite scary for someone to have a 70-pound German Shepherd with huge teeth coming at you. Now, Scarlett had all the training in place so that more training won't help her. The underlying emotion we are dealing with is fear. Fear is the basis for almost all aggressive behavior. The only exception I am aware of is predatory behavior. Dogs that chase squirrels and stalk birds are not fearful, but dogs that bark at the fence or bite children are often doing so to keep people and children away. I use the clicker on both of my dogs, but in different ways. For Flicka, I use the operant conditioning portion of clicker training, where I capture behavior that I want and reinforce it with a click and treat. For Scarlett, I use the classical condition portioning, which helps flood her system with those feel-good neurotransmitters. So behavior modification is working on the emotions to decrease fear in those situations. Once the fear is under control, then you can begin to communicate enough to teach sit and stay. Now, to recap the resources from this episode, here are the links. For position statements from the American Veterinary Society of Animal Behavior, go to avsab.org, that's avsab.org, and look under resources. Carolina Westland's blog is at https://illis.se/en/. You can find a certified fear-free vet at the website fearfreepets.com. And there is a wealth of information on the website drsophiayin.com. That's drsophiayin.com. So, to banish fear and spread laughter backwards in time, here is this episode's bonus question. How can you go for 8 days without sleeping? If you think you know the answer, send it to info@radiotacoma.org with bonus question in the subject line. Join us again for more sagas from the world of pet behavior problems. This is Dr. Louisa reminding you.
They ain't misbehaving. They're just behaving.
I don't stay out late, don't care to go. I'm home about 8, just me and my radio. Ain't misbehaving, saving my love for you. Ain't misbehaving, saving my love for you.